Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of how much the Republican establishment, now alarmed at the prospect of Donald Trump being the GOP standard bearer, is reaping what they have sown in terms of immigrant bashing, scapegoating minorities, and relentless and racist attacks on Barack Obama, all of which Trump has seized on, turning coded dog whistle politics into openly expressed bigotry, racism, and xenophobia. Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, joins us to discuss whether Trump is the Republicans' attack dog that has been fed and nurtured by the party, but has now grown strong enough to destroy its master. Then we'll look into charges made by Mitt Romney, of all people, that Donald Trump's unreleased tax returns contain a bombshell that is likely to reveal Trump has less wealth than he claims. David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who, because of his investigations, has been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States, joins us to discuss why Trump probably pays little to no tax and whether he takes fees for laundering the money of his silent partners, one of whom is rumored to be Vladimir Putin. Then finally, we'll get two opinions on tomorrow's parliamentary elections in Iran that have been heavily rigged by the hardliners running Iran who have purged candidates who might be reform-minded. A former State Department policy advisor, Suzanne Maloney, a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, joins us. Then we'll hear from Iranian-American historian Dr. Maziar Behrouz about whether disillusioned young Iranians will boycott the election that serves the interests of the hardliners by having the outward appearance of democracy while guaranteeing the results they want. And joining us now is Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Prophets of Protest, Reconsidering the History of American Abolitionism, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy McCarthy.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be back.
And in terms of the work that you've done on the history of America's radical tradition, are you surprised by the right-wing populism that's emerging with Donald Trump? I mean, his acceptance speech in Nevada was pretty extraordinary, where he went down the list of thanking the Christian Coalition and other groups, but then he said, I'd like to thank educated voters, and I'd like to thank the poorly educated voters. I love poorly educated voters. It's almost like an admission that he's bringing all kinds of people out of the woodwork.
Yeah, well, I don't think that what Donald Trump is doing is entirely new in the world, but I do think, and I agree with the recent New York Times article, I think it was published yesterday, that he is building, in the process of building, a new coalition of intolerance. And that we should take note of that. I mean, we have had examples in the past, whether you're talking about the Know Nothing Party in the 19th century, or you're talking about Father Coughlin during the 1930s, you're talking about George Wallace in the 1960s, Pat Buchanan in the 1980s and 1990s. I mean, we've had examples of political parties and political figures who have generated and ginned up this kind of intolerance and prejudice and downright hate before. This is not unprecedented in our history. But what you see with Trump is that he's making inroads into all of the constituencies that have formed the Republican coalition since the Reagan era of hawks and you know, fiscal conservatives and evangelical Christians and the like. But he's also making inroads into other types of voters. And so he's doing better than one would expect with Latino voters, at least in Nevada that was the case. He's made, you know, more inroads into the evangelical Christian community than one might expect, given the fact that Ted Cruz is someone who self-identifies as an evangelical Christian. Trump does not. And so I think we have to look, you know, he's generating interest among younger voters who are coming to his campaign. So it's interesting to see what's forming. It doesn't surprise me, but it concerns me. I guess that's how I would characterize it.
But isn't the Republican Party reaping the whirlwind of its own dog whistle politics here? I mean, it's not as if immigrant bashing just emerged with Donald Trump.
No.
It happened under Mitt Romney, you might recall.
Yes, of course. No, there's a long tradition of immigrant bashing in the United States. I mean, this is part of the lifeblood of our nation's history. We've been hostile to immigrants almost since the birth of the nation. The type of immigrant that receives that hostility has changed, of course, over time. Now it happens to be Mexicans and Muslims primarily, we've always in this country had a kind of xenophobic thread that runs throughout our political culture that targets outsiders or the latest boogeyman that's been constructed to project our hate onto. This is, in a sense, Donald Trump is the chickens coming home to roost in the Republican Party, and the Republican Party has been sowing, or elements of the Republican Party have been sowing these seeds of prejudice and hatred for many, many years with their anti-immigrant policies, with their racist social welfare policies, with their anti-woman reproductive health policies, with their anti-gay policies. I mean, there's, you name it, there is a whole set of policy. A whole policy agenda that has been constructed within the Republican Party and that has been promoted by the Republican Party that targets whole groups of people for discrimination and exclusion. And so this is nothing new. And so Donald Trump is sort of all of that on steroids. It's hard to believe, as someone who's old enough to remember Pat Buchanan's speech at the Republican convention in 1992, that someone could be even more bombastic, even more ignorant, even more brazen and racist and xenophobic in his speech, and also someone who's making more traction, getting more traction in the electorate. And certainly Donald Trump has gone beyond what we've ever seen before in American history, but we do have long traditions of this in our political culture. But the thing that we have to remember is that while this sort of toxic rhetoric, and I think Donald Trump has gone beyond dog whistle politics, as I think I mentioned before when I spoke with you earlier this year, I said that Donald Trump is not blowing the dog whistle, he's sounding the alarm bell, and I do think that that's true. It's louder and louder each day. And I think, what we see with Donald Trump is he's saying out loud what many people said euphemistically or through dog whistles in the past, but he's also speaking to an electorate at a time when there is both incredible economic anxiety that is spread across constituencies and across stakeholders and demographics in the United States, that is a result in part of the economic recession of 2008-2009, but also a result of a generation-long growth in inequality, of concentration of wealth at the top, of deregulation of government, of the private sector by the governments. So there's a widespread sense of economic inequality and disenfranchisement and disempowerment that people are feeling that's real. And he's speaking to that on some level. There's an irony, of course, in him being a billionaire speaking to that sensibility. But there's also a kind of a growing anxiety, a racial anxiety that manifests itself in anti-black violence and also in anti-immigrant rhetoric and violence that really is about the shrinking white population having to confront the reality of a growing population of people of color. And so the combination of that class anxiety and that race anxiety is something that is hitting a particular kind of nerve at this moment and reaching a kind of fever pitch that the volume of which is then dialed up by someone like Trump and his supporters. And I think that's what we're seeing. It's a particular context that Trump is speaking to that has historical roots but is also very much unique to this particular moment in American political history.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy, and the director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Prophets of Protest, Reconsidering the History of American Abolitionism, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. So, to broaden it out, Timothy McCarthy, there's an expression in the American vernacular which is "nice guys finish last," and the assumption is that the people are more likely to vote for you if you're tough and mean than they are if you're goody-two-shoes and, you know, peace, love, tree-hugging, all of that stuff that people are so quick to deride. So is that what's going on here, that in effect nastiness works and the opposite doesn't?
Well, you know, the optimist in me wants to say no to that question, that nice guys don't always finish last, and nice girls and nice people don't always finish last. There have been some very nice people that have done some great things in this world, and so I want to say that, and because I do think we're living in an age where optimism is hard to muster. So at least I'll let me muster it for a second here. But I do think that there is something to what you're saying. I mean, people both love and hate bullies, and Donald Trump is a bully. He's the loudest schoolyard bully that any of us can possibly imagine from our elementary schools and middle schools and high schools. And the thing about bullies is that bullies are fun to watch, and bullies are powerful sources of spectatorship when you are not the target of the bullying. I mean, think about, you know, when you were on a playground as a kid and the bully targets someone else and sort of mocks someone and makes fun of someone and makes a fool out of someone because of who they are, what they're wearing, or what they look like. Sometimes that elicits laughter. Sometimes, you know, our gaze is sort of fixed on that spectacle of someone bullying someone else. But when we're not the target, it's a lot harder to stand up. A lot more people are bystanders than upstanders in our culture. And that's what I think is happening with some of the people who are supporting Donald Trump. Is as long as he doesn't come at me, as long as he sticks with the Muslims and the Mexicans and the gays and the blacks and the women, as long as he doesn't come to us, then we're just going to sit here and laugh and watch the show. And I think that's something that's happening here. But what has to happen is that people need to start to step up and rise up and speak out and stand up to Donald Trump and people like him. Because ultimately, they are toxic, and ultimately, if they don't fall and crash and burn because of their hubris and because of their hatred, they're going to create a kind of toxic culture, right? They're either going to ruin the best of what we are, or they're going to crash and fall before they can do so. And it remains to be seen which of those things befalls or awaits Donald Trump. I mean, my sense is that he's a figure, a classic figure, a tragic figure who, because of his hubris, will ultimately be taken down. But, you know, you see the bullying. I mean, he did it to Jeb Bush. He's done it to all of his rivals on some level or another, but he's also doing it to vulnerable constituencies. But if you're not one of those vulnerable constituencies, you can sit idly by and have a laugh every now and then and enjoy the show rather than step up and say, you know what, this is not okay, because at some point he's going to turn his bile on to me. And, you know, you saw this with Jeb Bush. When Jeb Bush announced his campaign, he famously had that exclamation point. And what Trump did was a classic bully move. He said, Jeb Bush is low energy. And all of a sudden, that exclamation point seemed like an inappropriate punctuation or an ironic designation or symbol. And Jeb Bush never recovered from that. He was low energy. Donald Trump framed him in that way. And so he's bullying not only his opponents, but he's bullying, you know, populations of people who, I hasten to mention, can be the constitutive, you know, who will turn around and form another coalition. Right, the people that he's bullying, if we're lucky, and I consider myself as a gay person, one of the people he's bullying, what we need to do is form our own countervailing coalition that can defeat the coalition of intolerance that he's building as a result of his campaign.
But how far? I mean, I wouldn't in any way suggest that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, who are being hard-nosed about simply refusing to allow a nominee to replace Justice Scalia to be even considered, let alone voted on, that's not so much bullying, but it's hard-nosed, kind of thuggish, cynical behavior. So how distant is this, you know, Republican Senate led by Mitch McConnell from what you're talking about, Trump? I mean, it's a very in-your-face attitude, basically spitting at the Constitution and basically saying, you know, I think the Constitution makes it pretty clear that there are rules for government, and that a president has obligations and a Senate has obligations. It's not a game, you know, that you have you, under the Constitution, you are charged with obligations, and they're shirking those obligations, but it's like, screw you.
Mm. Yeah, well, we have to remember, go back to right when President Obama came into office. Mitch McConnell made it very clear at the time, his minority leader at the time, very clear that we are going to do everything we can in our power to ensure that he fails and is a one-term president. So Mitch McConnell made it very clear to the American public at the moment of Barack Obama's election that he wanted to make sure that Barack Obama failed. And so this is his last act in an eight-year drama of obstruction led by the Republicans in Congress, in both the Senate and the House of Representatives, against America's first black president. And I say America's first black president because I think it's relevant. I don't think it's a conspiracy theory to say that many of these people, including Mitch McConnell, who has, you know, said other racist things and done other racist things in his life, is not motivated on some level by the racial identity of the president. That one of the reasons they want to make him fail is because he was a first. He was a historic figure and could potentially be a transformative figure, and they didn't want that, right? And him being a Democrat only compounded that problem. So I think that, you know, it's not quite bullying, because the president, after all, is the president, and he has ways of doing what he needs to do, and we've seen that in quite grand form, actually, in the last year with these executive orders, and I think President Obama is not going out quietly. He's gonna go out doing his thing. And the president has a lot of power, and so in that sense, he's not being bullied because he's not a vulnerable person in our political system. He's one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful people in our political system. But it is obstruction. And it's not just obstruction of the first black president, of Barack Obama, of a Democratic White House. It is also obstruction of the Constitution. And the great irony here is that Scalia, in all the kind of the breathless celebrations of Anthony Scalia after his untimely death recently, all of the celebrations have at least one thing in common, is he was a brilliant jurist who is an originalist. His constitutional worldview, his jurisprudence, was rooted in this idea that the Constitution should be interpreted based on what the founding fathers originally intended the Constitution to do. And if you are an originalist, if you are going to honor the originalism of the late Antonin Scalia, then you have to hold hearings to replace him on the Supreme Court, because that's what the Constitution instructs the President and the Senate to do. If you're an originalist, then you have to do it because it's your constitutional mandate. It's what the Founding Fathers wanted. But if you're not an originalist, and I don't happen to be, but I have read the Constitution and I have read the constitutional debates, then it's clear that that is exactly what the process that was put in place. It's just an obstruction of our political culture. It's an obstruction of our society. If the Supreme Court can't function at its fullest capacity, then part of our governmental structure, part of our society, is crippled. Right, is burdened by that incapacity. And that's at this moment in our political history, right, when we have so many things that we have to get done and that we have to resolve and that we have to debate, it's actually malfeasance. It's a violation of the Constitution. It's downright, I'll say it, it's un-American for the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, to say they're not going to hold hearings. And I hope Obama fights this fight. I hope Obama steps into that last drama between Obama and McConnell and wins, because I don't think they can obstruct for a year. They can't obstruct. It will be the longest we've gone without someone sitting in a Supreme Court seat in the history of the Republic. And the electorate is not going to go for this. I mean, getting back to your point about nice guys finish last, I cannot believe that a majority of Americans are going to stand for this, that the country is going to sit idly by and watch this obstruction and this miscarriage of justice and this violation of the Constitution just to get one more dig in against America's first black president. I just don't see that flying with the electorate. And as such, I think the Republicans are making a huge, huge mistake and a huge, huge gamble.
Well, just in the last minute then, Timothy McCarthy, perhaps what Trump and the Republican senators have in common, led by Mitch McConnell, is meanness. And then the question arises, can Trump and or the Republican Senate be shamed into doing the right thing, or are they shameless? And in the case of Trump, do you expect a moment like they had with the McCarthy running roughshod over calling everybody communist, when eventually it took the army's lawyer to say, "Sir, have you no shame?"
Yeah.
Do you expect that moment?
I hope that moment comes, but I'm not holding my breath. I don't think that Donald Trump is shameless. I don't think he has any shame at all. I think his hubris is what's going to ultimately bring him down. And the electorate coming to its senses, I think, will starting with reasonable Republicans. And there are many reasonable Republicans. I know a few myself. Many of these folks are shameless, but they're also selfish. And this is the thing. It's not just that they're without shame. It's that they're so self-centered. They're so preoccupied with their own political power, staying in power, of not sharing any power with anybody who's of another party or of another race or across some line of difference. And that, to me, is toxic. We live in a world where many different kinds of people have to get along, where many, many different kinds of people need to have the rights of citizenship, where many different kinds of people need government in order to live their lives fully. And for, a segment of one of the political parties to have the selfish desire to shut down government just to make a mockery of the outgoing president, or to prevent a balance of power from tipping in a different direction, to me is not selfless behavior. And what we want in our political officials, what we want in the people representing us on behalf of the common good, are selfless people, people that can subordinate their own self-interest. Getting back to what the founding fathers talked about, they talked about that a lot, that we need to subordinate our self-interest in order to serve on behalf of the common good. And Mitch McConnell and his Republican cronies in Congress, who are stonewalling on the Scalia replacement, are not serving the common good. They are serving self-interest, refusing to subordinate it, and therefore undermining our democracy and our common political aspirations. And they will suffer consequences for it, I'm sure. If not in the public mind, then certainly at the polls in November.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Timothy McCarthy.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy, and the director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He is the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Prophets of Protest, Reconsidering a History of American Abolitionism, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking at the charges made by Mitt Romney, of all people, that Donald Trump's unreleased tax returns contain a bombshell.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain, as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he has been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He's the best-selling author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, and the editor of an anthology, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Ian, glad you had me back.
And David, what do you make of this remark by Mitt Romney on Fox News? Just quoting him, "I think Donald Trump's case is likely to be a bombshell." He's talking about releasing the tax returns. Of course, it's a bit ironic that this should be coming from Mitt Romney, who had a problem with his tax returns back in 2012. But what do you think he's getting at? What kind of smoking gun might there be? What Romney hinted at is that Trump, quoting, "may not have as much income as he has advertised."
Well, Trump boasts about his wealth, not his income. I suspect that the reason that Donald will be reluctant to release his returns and will release maybe only two, which is what Romney did, is that he probably pays little or no income tax because of a little-known law Congress passed in the 1990s. Now, I got a hold of Trump's tax data back 25 years ago, and it's in my book, Temples of Chance, and what it shows is that when Trump graduated from college and went to work for his father, the first 2 years he had sort of a successful, nice income, and he paid a normal tax rate, and then all of a sudden his income went negative. Now, 1 year, I think it was negative $4 million, and he therefore paid no income taxes. If you and I, or most of the listeners, want to go into the real estate business, and you own a house or a little apartment building somewhere, you are only allowed to deduct $25,000 of paper losses against your wages. So if you have a $100,000 salary and you have a $25,000 loss, you're treated as if you had a $75,000 salary. But there's this little provision of the law that says that if you were a full-time real estate professional, and Trump clearly qualifies as a full-time real estate professional, you can deduct unlimited amounts of depreciation on your real estate against your cash income. So even if Trump made the wildly inflated $40 million he claims he was paid for the last year of The Apprentice, I'm looking at the buildings that he's put in his disclosure statement, I would be surprised if his depreciation losses don't exceed $40 million, and therefore he paid no tax. That's going to be the problem. And, of course, this was Romney's problem. This is why Romney would only release 2 years of taxes. Private equity managers also are covered by a special rule, and that rule says if you're a private equity manager, and remember, Mitt Romney was the sole owner of Bain Capital Management, the sole owner, something most of the news media missed, he was allowed to defer all of the gains back into the fund and defer paying taxes on them. So he likely paid little to no tax in many of the years that he was running Bain.
So far, Donald Trump, of course, has not responded in any useful way, but he's just responded in this kind of bullying way by calling Romney a dope and other insults. So how long do you think he can get away with that?
Well, there's no way that Trump will release any tax data unless he gets the nomination. And way back in June, when every national journalist I know except for me was saying this is a joke and he'll never get the nomination, I was alone saying, I think he might get it. I don't think it's likely, but I think he might get it. And I don't see any reason for Trump, unless he actually has the nomination in hand, to release his tax returns. And then you watch, he'll be very selective. He'll give you 1 or 2 years, and he'll probably cite Romney as his example. He'll give you 1 year and say, well, I'll give you the next one, you know, when it's prepared, and it'll be due October 15th, because you're allowed legally to, you know, delay your filing till October 15th. You know, remember that Trump's focus is on his wealth, not his income, and that's for a reason. Wealth is a very fungible concept. My analysis of his public disclosure, he says he's worth $10 billion. Forbes magazine says $4.3 billion. My analysis is we know he's worth $1.1 billion. Everything above that is speculative as to its value.
Well, so here he is running around with a self-finance campaign and bragging. And do you think he has to worry about putting gas in the jet?
No, not at all. But you know, it's really not a self-financed campaign. Understand that a lot of people have sent in money, and a great deal of the minimal amount of money that he's spent was from these donors. The money he's put into the campaign, he loaned to the campaign. He didn't give it to the campaign. So if he later has a fundraising operation, he can recover all of that. Donald is unquestionably a wealthy guy. I mean, he started out on third base, and he's collected enormous welfare from the government. I mean, just one deal he did, the Grand Hyatt Hotel at Grand Central Station in New York, the city of New York, under Mayor Abe Beam, who was the longtime close friend of Fred Trump, Donald's father, he got a $400 million welfare deal. And Trump has collected welfare from the taxpayers all over the place. He's been the beneficiary of a whole variety of government rules that he violated with impunity or favors that governments did for him. And a great deal of his fortune comes from these actions by government. And Trump himself, you know, brags about this. There's a wonderful documentary, Trump the Movie, which you can watch for free on the Internet, that Donald suppressed 25 years ago. And in that movie, you will see him brag about buying politicians.
Well, he's bragged about, in a rally in January, bragged about paying as little as possible in taxes because that's the American way.
So, right. Right. And in that sense, I mean, I would be surprised if there's anything illegal in Donald's returns. Donald is has so much income that he probably is audited, as he says, every year, or close to every year, by either the IRS or the state of New York, and he has a multi-state tax return, of course, because he has businesses around the country. So I would expect that he is following the rules, but the scandal is the rules. The rules are that you and I have our taxes taken out of our checks before we get our paycheck or our pension check or our distribution from our 401k if we're retired. Trump is allowed to defer his taxes way into the future. Well, that's effectively a zero-interest loan from the government of the value of the taxes. I mean, imagine, Ian, if all the years you've worked in the United States, you could have kept the income taxes withheld from your pay, invested them, and then with no interest adjustment paid them, say, 10 years from now. You think the interest alone would make you prosperous?
But this is just a result of the oligarchical takeover of the United States, isn't it? I mean, it's such
absolutely. This is what I've spent the last 25 years of my life trying to get people to understand, that the system is not what you were taught in school. It's not what the politicians talk about. It has been rigged to take from the many to enrich the few, and Trump is one of the big beneficiaries of it. So is Warren Buffett. Bill Gates is not one of the big beneficiaries of this, but Warren Buffett certainly is, and Donald Trump, relative to the size of his fortune, is an enormous beneficiary. And if my analysis is correct, that he's really worth a little over $1 billion, all of his wealth can be traced back to the taxpayers giving him welfare.
So, but what is the source of his wealth? There are all kinds of rumors that, of course, in the construction business in New York, obviously, there's a lot of, you know, organized crime influence over the unions. I understand that he's used a lot of undocumented Polish workers to build some of his buildings.
There's a piece that I wrote called 21 Questions for Donald Trump. It's at Alternet. It was actually written for National Memo. It's at National Memo. And I, in question form, lay out this stuff about how Donald used undocumented workers, just as he uses them right now. The New York Times reported today at his Mar-a-Lago place. He didn't just do business with the mob. He went out of his way to do business with the mob, and the people he did business with weren't just anybody mobsters. It was Fat Tony Salerno and Paul Castellano, the head of the two biggest mob families in New York, and he shared with those two mobsters a lawyer, the notorious Roy Cohn. So Trump made a tremendous amount of money in Atlantic City, where he never had a single dollar invested. In his book, The Art of the Deal, he brags about how he borrowed all the money and then took a fee for himself for his first project. He then lied and deceived his investors from the Holiday Inn Corporation, which owned Harrah's casinos. And when he got his next casino, he bragged that he borrowed all the money and then took a $5 million fee to himself. And the same thing with the Taj Mahal Casino. that Trump never had a dollar invested. So the cash flow was enormous to him until the business turned and all these people lost their work and things fell apart.
Well, that's my understanding, is that his money comes from management fees and that the silent partners, though, and this has not been confirmed, but there's some pretty reliable people that I've spoken to. They say that a lot of his the sort of his silent partners, if you will, are rich right-wing Israeli businessmen, many coming out of Russia.
And that there's a whole, in terms of his current deals, Ian, Donald doesn't build anymore. He licenses his name. You know, there's where you are in Southern California, there's the Trump's golf course out there at Palos Verdes. He gets paid a licensing fee for his name. And, you know, when he was told that he couldn't build houses on part of it because that's an earthquake zone, you know, the road along there is always being shut down because of earth slides, he then claimed that he was cheated out of $26 million, and he dedicated the land forever as open space. Well, the open space is it's the driving range for the golf course. And one of the things we don't know is did he take a $26 million tax deduction for the value of the land he couldn't develop that he never should have been able to develop. When he bought it, he should have known, or when his partners bought it, they should have known that he couldn't do that. But that's one of those issues where unless the IRS challenges you and gets in a big fight with you, and it would be a big fight with Trump, you get away with that kind of stuff.
Well, it remains to be seen, I guess, whether in terms of the Israeli billionaires, Russians, many of them Russians, that supposedly are Osama's partners, whether some of the money that is being laundered is Putin's money. That would be maybe that.
Well, that would be another question: is Donald? I mean, is Donald involved in helping people launder money? Why does he speak so highly of this murderous dictator Vladimir Putin? I think there are tons of questions that he needs to be thoroughly vetted, and I am totally frustrated that my peers at the big national papers, the New York Times and the LA Times, both of which I worked at for many years, the Washington Post, they keep writing what I regard as basically namby-pamby pieces about Trump. They're not doing the serious work. Now, the kickback I've gotten from one of my peers who called me at home was, it's too early to do that. He doesn't have the nomination yet. What an interesting idea. We'll wait till the man gets nominated, then we'll look at his record.
Right. Well, that would be a Democratic strategy to wait, but not a press.
Sure, that makes sense. I agree with you. If I'm Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, that's my strategy. I don't want to burn him out too soon because I want to run against him because I get the best chance against him.
Sure, but it's not the job of the press. I thank you, David, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Glad to talk to you anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States, and he's the best-selling author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, and the editor of the anthology Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with two opinions on tomorrow's rigged parliamentary elections in Iran.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Suzanne Maloney, who's a Senior Fellow of Foreign Policy in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, the political economy of the Persian Gulf, and Middle East energy policy. A former U.S. State Department policy advisor, she is the author of Iran's Long Reach, Iran as a Pivotal State in the Muslim World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Suzanne Maloney.
Thanks so much.
And on Friday, Iran's having its parliamentary elections, which have been seems to have been largely rigged by the Guardian councils, which is this hardline body that decides which candidates can run for the 290 seats in the parliament. Apparently, there have been 6,200 candidates, but very few of the reformers have made it. Indeed, some members of parliament on the very small reform slate have been disqualified. So why should we? I mean, it seems like in a way, the supreme leader and the hardliners want the world to take their democracy seriously. But how can you take it seriously when it's so obviously rigged?
Well, Iranian elections are orchestrated by the regime, and there are real constraints on what we would interpret should be a truly free and fair election. Nonetheless, they are competitive ballots. There are thousands of Iranians, there were slightly over 6,000, who were ultimately qualified to run for the 290 parliamentary seats. About 1,500 of those dropped out, but you still have a fairly large number of prospective candidates. They certainly don't represent the entire ideological spectrum among Iranians, but there is enough of a choice that it does appear, and at least the polling by reputable Iranian firms seems to confirm, that there should be reasonably strong turnout for these elections tomorrow. And ultimately, we've seen over the years that Iranian elections, even within these very, very narrow regime controlled constraints, can have a real impact on policy. I think that's less true with respect to the parliament than it would be for an office like the presidency. But we know that these have been critical junctures, opportunities for the regime to move in one direction or another, and real important opportunities for the population to mobilize around particular political ideas, including ideas for changing the system.
But my understanding is that the population has a great deal of expectation that things are going to get better now that international sanctions have been removed. And to what extent do you think that President Rouhani is not going to be able to meet those expectations simply because he's being so constrained, and he's likely to be constrained even further by a more hardline parliament that is likely to be elected tomorrow?
You know, Rouhani's actually dealt reasonably constructively with the parliament that's been in place, and that has been a conservative-dominated parliament. He himself is not a reformist by ideological association and has a long history of kind of working across factional lines within Iran. So I don't suspect that the parliament itself is going to be a major obstacle for him, but you're absolutely right to point out that it's going to be very difficult for the Iranian government to meet the expectations of the population for a very rapid and significant trickle-down effect from the nuclear deal and the sanctions relief that has followed. There are real structural issues with the Iranian economy that will take time to resolve. Rouhani's put in place a team of technocrats who are intending to do that, but reform is always much harder in practice than it is in theory. And I think, you know, there's liable to be some disconnect between the peace dividend that Iranians hope for and the kind of job creation that they're likely to see over the course of the next couple of years.
But it is extraordinary to think that Hassan Khamenei, the grandson of the founder of the Islamic Republic, was one of those disqualified. So in terms of the politics within the theocracy, Is the purpose of the hardliners, the IRGC and the supreme leader, are they modeling their economy and polity in to some extent on the Chinese model, where you have an relatively open economy to the world, but essentially you can control the media, the military, the press, etc.? Is that the model that they're following?
I think there are some who'd like to follow that model, but obviously Iran is not as large or as attractive an economy as the Chinese have. And so, in effect, they haven't moved quite in that same direction. The Iranians are still much more reluctant to embrace wholesale market reforms and opening to the world in terms of foreign investment. They've come a long way over the course of the past 37 years. But clearly there's more appetite and more political space for economic reform than there would be for significant political liberalization or even meaningful social reforms. So that will be the place where Rouhani focuses his efforts, and I think the regime is banking on the expectation that some new foreign investment coming in the wake of sanctions relief will be sufficient to enable this system to continue to retain some legitimacy among the population. And so far they've been right in that bet. We'll see what happens.
But it does seem, though, that that essentially the power rests – I don't think there's any mystery that the power rests with the Supreme Leader. And he seems to be – at least reports indicate that he may be in poor health. There have been reports that he has stage 5 prostate cancer. So I know that his son, Mujtaba Khamenei, who I believe is a pretty hardline member of the IRGC – I think he was the guy that pushed for Ahmadinejad's presidency, and is he making a play to replace his father? I mean, he doesn't have the religious credentials, nor did his father. But what's happening there in terms of a likely succession?
We really don't know. I mean, I'm skeptical about Mujtaba Khamenei as a really viable prospect for replacing his father. Iranians have an instinctive skepticism and distrust for anything that resembles a monarchical succession. So I don't think that that would be a widely popular move, irrespective of his factional identification or philosophical preferences. You know, there is a body also being elected tomorrow that would, in theory at least, select the next Supreme Leader. It's most likely to be someone who comes from the same segment of the political establishment, the conservative clergy. And it will unlikely produce any real change. That said, we really don't know Khamenei's health. He was treated for prostate cancer over a year ago. But, you know, this is a man still in his mid-70s, and it could be, I think, quite a long time before he passes from the scene.
So when we think about the Green Revolution that took place a few years ago and how brutally it was put down by the besieged militia and the IRGC, and the general impression is that that the hardliners have won and somehow the people have been cowed into submission. And I believe the women and the young and the educated still chafe under the restrictions of the militias and the IRGC. But there are people like Shireen Ebadi who keep talking about the ashes burning under the embers in terms of the reform movement sort of percolating on the back burner. How would you describe it?
I think there's always going to be energy behind some sort of reform and change within the system. This is clearly not a political balance that is considered acceptable to a wide array of Iranians. That said, it does appear, at least at the moment, that there is more stronger preference for gradual evolutionary change and working within the system to see what might be possible. That can change in a heartbeat, as it did back in 2009, and I think it's not inconceivable that we would see Iran in a similar position of unrest at some point in the future. But at least for the moment, I don't think that that's a near-term proposition.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. This is Anne Maloney.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Suzanne Maloney, who's a senior fellow of foreign policy in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, the political economy of the Persian Gulf, and Middle East energy policy. A former U.S. State Department policy advisor, she is the author of Iran's Long Reach, Iran as a Pivotal State in the Muslim World. And joining us now is Iranian-American historian Mazia Behrouz, who was born in Tehran and has taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford University and is currently a professor of history at San Francisco State University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mazia Behrouz.
Thank you for having me.
And the elections on Friday in Iran are pretty clearly rigged in advance. where so many of the liberal candidates have already been purged by the hardliners who control the vetting process. They seem to have been more, you know, active this year or in this election than in previous ones in this 37 years of the Islamic Republic. So are the hardliners getting more hardline in Iran?
I think you can say that. They are getting more hardline, but the question is how, you know, considering the peculiarities of the Iranian system, the question is how successful they are in being that hardline. They are vetting, yes. They are trying to eliminate the known candidates that they possibly can eliminate from running for election. But there are a lot of people who are not known to them, to the hardliners, in terms of who they are, what their political stance is, and so they cannot vet them. So there are a lot of people, very many people, who are participating in this election as candidates and whose political leaning is not very clear to the people who were put in charge of vetting them.
So there could be some surprises in the, what, 6,300 candidates running for 291 seats, is that right?
Something like that. And then there is also another interesting development. A movement had started in Iran that instead of saying who to elect, they tried to say to the electorate who not to elect. You know, they basically, you know, using social media, they are basically telling people, you know, don't vote for this person or that person, especially for the election of the Council of Experts. Because, as you know, there are two elections going on in Iran. One is for the parliament, which is the number is what you just mentioned, and the other one is for the Council of Experts, which is going to be the constitutional body who would choose the leader of the Islamic Republic, the supreme leader, in the event of his death. So that election has become very important as well. Usually it's not that important because it didn't do much, but since the current leader is viewed to be in ill health, and people are kind of sensing that a successor for him may need to be elected very soon, this election for the Council of Experts has become very important and vital.
So what's happening then with the reform movement that supposedly got a big boost from the new president, and particularly from his ability to make the deal to end the sanctions? And I believe there's a lot of expectation that things are going to change, but that seems to be what alarms the hardliners.
So, well, he tried to, of course, pull Iran out of the international isolation that Iran has been put into by the policies of the previous administration, Ahmadinejad, and he was successful. The hardliners, it seems, and I must say that they are not uniform, and they haven't even been able to, I'm talking about the hardliners, to produce a single candidate list for their cause. So there's a split between the hardliners too. We can call them moderate hardliners and really more radical hardliners. The hardliners, of course, have been trying to, especially the radical hardliners, have been trying to prevent that achievement, the foreign policy achievement, the removal of sanctions and all that, translate into further opening of society internally. And but the fact is, I mean, the reality is that these lines between hardliners, moderate, radical, reform, these are all becoming more and more blur as we get closer to this election. The lists that they have produced, you know, some of the lists produced by different groups in terms of endorsement and all that, includes reformers, includes moderates, includes moderate conservatives, includes radical conservatives. So, I mean, the fault lines have moved considerably ever since the election process started.
So where does the reform movement, in terms of what we witnessed back with the Green Revolution, my understanding is that the young professionals, educated people, mostly in the urban areas, chafe under the restrictions of the Bashir's militia and the IRGC and the hardline clerics, all of whom have apparently made themselves incredibly rich, at least as Khamenei's family certainly have. And are they going to participate in this vote? Will they sort of protest, you know, sort of silently? Or what's your sense of the extent to which, as Shireen Abadi says, the embers are burning under the ashes?
The leaders of the Green Movement, the ones who are under house arrest and have been there for the past 5 years, have all asked people to participate in the election. They have asked people to participate in election with, knowing the restrictions that we just talked about, the vetting and all that, and use the election as an opportunity to foster change, to push forward with change, to try to have a parliament, to elect a parliament that is more supportive of government policies rather than an obstructionist parliament. So that's in terms of the reform movement as its leadership and as its relates to the Green Movement during the election in 2009. In terms of the reform candidates, well, many of them have been vetted out, the known ones, and they are not standing for election, but overwhelmingly endorsing people participating in the election. So we have that aspect to this. There are calls for boycotting the election. Some of these calls are from inside the country. Much of it is from the outside of the country because of the vetting, because of the way elections being held and all that. But overwhelmingly, it seems that even the opposition within the government, the reform movement, is also, or at least its key political players, are asking people to do participate in the election and try to bring about change through electing a more moderate parliament rather than an obstructionist parliament.
But surely participating in a rigged election also doesn't it play into the hands of the hardliners, because they want to maintain this idea that there is an Islamic democracy. They want to have it both ways. They want to maintain control but have the outward appearance of a popular vote.
True. That is very true. They want it. They want the cake and they want to eat it too. And that is but the other side of this is that there are people living in Iran, and they hope to have a better life. They hope to have benefits from this lifting of the sanctions and improvement. They want the economy to improve, and they want more freedom, social and political freedoms, and short of a revolutionary change or a civil war like Syria, which there is no prospects for it in Iran, it seems that the collective idea or the collective consciousness is, you know, use whatever tools you have at your disposal, even if it is if the election is conducted the way it is conducted right now, to promote change in the country and push the country toward more moderation rather than more conservative policies and obstructionist policies.
Well, Mezeh Behrouz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. It's nice talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Iranian-American historian Mezeh Behrouz, who was born in Tehran and has taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford University and is currently a professor of history at San Francisco State University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.